Clojure Script is a high-level scripting language built on top of Clojure, which is built on top of Lisp, which is built on top of Java, and I already don't know what I'm talking about here, and I didn't from the beginning either. Basically, it's a scripting language that allows for pretty easy software implementations of these very broad topics to make it a very easy way to interact with servers and things like that. Our guest today, Mike Fikes, is taking Clojure Script and he wants to bring it into the real world using hardware that he's designed. So he's been designing an ESP32-based device that he is manufacturing himself, he's selling them, he's putting these things out into the world so that he can bring Clojure Script to the masses and actually do some real-world modifications of his environment, lighting up LEDs, driving motors, all of the usual things you might want to do with low-level hardware, but he's doing with a very, very, very high-level language. And Mike is a great example of someone who's taking electronics and the knowledge that he's gained within the electronics field and applying it to his normal field of software. And he's doing this for his company, but also for his personal enrichment. That's another thing that comes through in this episode. I really enjoyed learning about how Mike is learning and teaching himself. He does two things that are, I think, great examples. One is he takes Ben Eder's class, which is basically Ben has a set of videos on YouTube where he shows you how to build a computer from the ground up. It's a wonderful resource, especially if you want to get into like vintage electronics, but even just understanding how a CPU works, building a custom CPU. Boy, there's not many better ways to do that, and building it on a breadboard. So he'll show some of that. And then the second one is he got a mentor who's Bill Hurd. Bill Hurd helped build the Commodore C128, and both Ben and Bill have been guests on my other podcast, The Amp Hour, and so we will link that in as well. Both are really great teachers and electronics designers, as is Mike. Mike has really been showing that he has dug into this field, and he is a software person, natively software, building on this hardware stuff. So I'm excited to show you and talk to Mike Fikes here, and hope you enjoy episode 5 of the Contextual Electronics Podcast. Welcome back to the Contextual Electronics Podcast. Today we're talking to Mike Fikes, who is involved with Clojure Script and has built some of his own hardware. And I'm going to bring Mike on screen here. Mike, thank you for coming on the Contextual Electronics Podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Hi, Chris. Yeah, I'm excited to be here as well. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. I mean, so you are coming from a software background. Contextual Electronics Podcast, we're kind of interested in people coming from lots of different realms into the electronics space. So I'm very curious about what that looks like, you coming into the electronic space from the software side.
Yeah. So I've been like a software engineer my whole life, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And it's only been over the past 3 years or so that I've been getting into electronics. I was thinking about this and I'm like, what got me into it? What kind of sucked me into this whole thing? And it was honestly, there were a set of videos that Ben Eder had put together where he was building a computer based on TTL chips, a breadboard computer. And that was great for me, you know, from coming from a software background, because to be honest, I never really understood how computers worked at the bottom, you know?
Yeah. I think the Ben Eder videos are amazing. If people haven't checked those out, his YouTube channel, he built it all up from the ALU up through the processing, pushing code through it. So like what are those videos?
I actually got the book. There's a book that he based his stuff on. So if you know, of course, I think I learned best by just watching his videos. But if you want to dig deeper, the book has like all the, you know, the same stuff roughly. And what he ends up building is one of the computers. It's called the SAP in this book, the simplest possible computer. and I actually have one here that I can show real quick. It's basically a partially completed one. But it's like, you know, for me, it was like, you know, coming from a software background, of course, you can understand like logic. You're in software, you're dealing with Boolean values and whatnot. And that's what a lot of this stuff is gates and whatnot. And so it's like, it's a pretty easy introduction to electronics because you're not dealing with a bunch of analog stuff, maybe. Is that a better way to put it?
Well, everything's analog. Let's
yes,
be honest.
Exactly. Yeah. At the bottom, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And if you were going to have problems, you might see the signals, you know, not rising fast enough or
definitely.
But that's really the fun thing about that kind of. So just to describe for people that are just listening, it's a breadboard. It's a very big breadboard. It's probably what, like 18 inches by 12 inches?
It's a total of like maybe like 7 breadboards.
Yeah, it's like the size of a large square pizza, rectangle pizza.
With lots of chips on it and wires sticking out everywhere, jumpers.
Yeah, and so how many chips are on there? Do you have like a kind of a statistical?
Oh, it looks like maybe like 20 to 40, but I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the wiring. Yeah. So it is point to point wiring.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So it, like you said, I do remember, that like the analog stuff comes into play, especially like with the power supply, the power lines going everywhere. It gets kind of like hokey, or even some of the, like the clock, there's a clock down in the lower corner and the clock lines, you know, they, by the time they make it to the other side of the board,
even
at this, you know, you're running these things at really slow rates. So, you know, it doesn't matter that much, but you get to see it, you know, if you hook up an oscilloscope to it. And I didn't even have an oscilloscope when I was building this. So it's kind of you know, I was just getting into it. And the
I mean, that's perfect though. 'Cause that shows the, you know, the true effects of inductance and capacitance and like, and resistance of the lines and just like how it's going to end up impacting your signals as it traverses a much larger area than in a, you know, basically you're building up a CPU and much, much larger than what a traditional what a CPU is these days. You know, you get an 8051 these days, it's going to be tiny little speck of sand, basically. So
And just to put things in perspective, at that point in time, I didn't even know that you needed to add a resistor to an LED, right? I just thought, you know, you could probably think back how long ago it was that you learned that. But for me, it was just a few years ago.
You know, some days I wonder if I even ever learned that, you know.
Oh, okay. Repeatedly forget and do it again. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great, though. And that kind of hands-on, I mean, we obviously love hands-on around here. You know, what were some of the things that you were able to draw out of a project like that? I mean, project-based education, another favorite of ours.
For me, it was like this, like the light went on in my head of how computers actually work. And, you know, even like the simple idea of what a clock is, you know, I'd never really thought about it. I thought a clock was just like an actual clock, like a wall, you know, something that told time. I didn't know that all it was a square wave driving things, you know, and also another part that I found really interesting was down the middle of this thing is a bus. And just the notion that you had like the tri-state stuff, you know, like high Z and you would have like different parts of the computer. You know, most of the chips are turned off. They're all in high Z mode, just not doing anything, but only one person writes to the bus. And that I found extremely intriguing, just understanding like how a bus works, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I think that, yeah, these are terms that you might've heard, but again, you don't have the physical implementation because, especially maybe coming from the software world, like a lot of stuff just gets abstracted. It's like, oh yeah, bus, whatever, you know, like, you know, throw the signal onto the bus, right? If you're using like a I2C line or something like that.
Yeah.
And yet it is, it's shared lines, it's shared power. It's, you know, it's these things that make the terminology very, very real, it seems like.
Yeah. Another one of those is microcode. I had heard of the term microcode, never thought about what it really meant. And Ben Eater goes all the way down to the bottom and explains to you, you know, like if you're going to implement a move instruction in your language, you know, below, you know, there's the clock rate. And then the way Ben Eater explains it really well, it's like below that's like another clock that's going even faster, maybe six cycles for every real clock cycle. And the microcode is just basically, I like to think of it as like the way like a four-stroke lawnmower engine works, you know, it's just at the bottom, like it's the gears underneath all of it, like, and it's how you actually implement the instruction set. You know, if you say I want to move some stuff from this register into RAM, you know, you have like this, the few, you know, the fetch cycle and all these little things below that. And that's, to me, it was like, man, this is awesome, you know.
Yeah,
it's like now I understand, there's no, it's like the magic goes away once you get to that. It's like I've seen the magic now, and it's sad that you now know how it works, but it's like your mind gets blown.
So I mean, well, then kind of moving back up the stack then, so like how has this started to impact your everyday as someone who's still doing software and like does it change how you think about things, or now is it like, you know, out of sight, out of mind, whatever resistors, I don't care.
Yeah. So for me, it was just like this side hobby, and I'm like, and it got me really interested in it. And then I started to want to learn like, you know, the analog parts of it that I wasn't getting, you know, and I discovered, you know, this stuff, the art of electronic stuff. Right.
Oh, well, yeah.
And it surprisingly, it took me like a couple of years to discover that this thing existed.
Well, I think that's actually the right amount of time for art of electronics is a lot of people say to start with that. And I say,
is actually not the art of electronics itself. This
that's
is
the workbook, right?
Yeah. And it's like,
yeah, that's, I mean, that's a great one. And so you didn't actually, so did you get the art of electronics book?
I do have that as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And I agree. It's kind of like, man, you don't want to just sit down and read that thing.
I mean, and like, that's a, you know, that's a common one I see in, you know, forum posts. What book should I get to get started? I'm like, that is not.
Yeah.
It's just too much. It's too dense. And, you know, it took me years and years to get through it. And And you keep going back to it, of course. It's like this great reference.
It's like an encyclopedia, right? I mean, you just
Exactly. Yeah, you don't go and start reading about aardvarks and, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Britannica yeah. or Wikipedia, I suppose, these days. You know, yeah. Britannica, kids are like, what's Britannica? but yeah, I mean, I think that is kind of, it can really hurt your motivation and your momentum, right? And momentum is always a big thing that I talk about. Is like,
you
have to get some small projects under your belt before you can start to build it up. I mean, so when you were doing the breadboard project, was there small elements that build up to a big element, or is it just kind of like dive in, start hooking things up?
Oh yeah. So this is also credit to Ben Eater. The way he does things is each part of the breadboard is a separate piece, and you just go through and learn like, how do you make a 555 work to make a timer out of it? You know? Uh-huh. So you get like a lot of the immediate, you know, feedback of what you're doing, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not like this fire hose that's too much to take in at once. You learn as you're going.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So definitely. Yeah. I've thought about this, like the software field is pretty broad and there's so much to know. And the same thing can be said about the hardware field. There's just like so much stuff to know. You could like drown in all of it, right?
I mean, well, it's going to be the rest of my career, Mike. So, I mean, yes, I know. But yeah, about every 2 to 3 years, I usually find a new field. I'm like, oh, well, here we go. Dive in. Let's start doing RF. Let's start doing FPGA. Let's start doing firmware. You know,
yeah, like, and even in RF electronics, I'm just like learning how BJT transistors work to make, you know, little emitter follower amplifiers, stuff that you don't even probably even use that much today, but it's like the basis for a lot of stuff, I guess.
Sure. Well, and I think actually that's a great point though. Like, so if you were, say you're doing audio processing. So one of the past courses of contextual electronics, we did, you know, a class A amplifier, which is just that. It's a BJT amplifier, a BJT transistor and a couple resistors, and you got to bias the transistor properly. And it's, you know, it's there's a lot of analog weirdness you got to deal with and learn about. And it's tough. But if you're a audio nut, right, you might be like, oh yeah, I know all about like my favorite JFET, or, you know, like how to bias properly. And, you know, the efficiency curves of, not the efficiency curve, but just the efficiency of doing class A amplifier, which is very, very low. And I'm willing to do that for the sound. And, you know, like, and then you get into the audiophile crowd. So yeah, there's, and I think it is, it's these, you know, these silos of different, you know, institutional knowledge that might be out there. Mm-hmm. But then if you zoom back out as a electronics level, you can really, you can start to sample lots of different topics. So are there other things in RF electronics that you're interested in getting into?
So the next thing will be like the whole op amp thing, right? That's the next.
Okay. Yep.
And at this point I can say that I know what they are, but I have not, you know, I haven't dealt with all the weird intricacies of how you can hook them up in various ways, you know?
Oh yeah. So that was a job for me for about 5 years. And it's that rabbit hole just keeps on going down and down and down, especially if you do precision measurement. It is limitless. But yeah, they're fun things to learn about. And so what are you looking to build with that? Is that back to the 8-bit computer or something else?
So it's, for me, that has been largely, I would say, the whole art of electronics and all that stuff has largely been, once Ben Eater got me sucked into this whole thing, it's just been like this, you know, this desire to learn and kind of like, and the cool thing is, it's like, if it's a hobby, you can consume it at your own rate, right? You know, there's no job deadlines or whatever where you have to figure out this op amp, you know.
No boss isn't breathing down your neck or anything.
Yeah, yeah. But it did start to seep into work a bit. And that's, that. Maybe we could talk about that a little bit next led. So, you know, I'm like, you know, when you're learning this stuff, you're like, oh, that'd be cool to do this stuff at work, right? It's like, this is so exciting. I would like to actually like do this as my day job, you know, because it's just so cool. And it turned out at work, we had like a software based product, if you will. It was an identity product, and we started using that to unlock locks, specifically locks in cars, was what we were looking into. And I basically I had put together like stuff based on what I had learned out of, you know, from Ben Eater and whatnot. I put together a demo on a breadboard that had an LED and it had a resistor. And I was like demoing how to use our software to like pretend to unlock a lock where the LED would light up.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
And the feedback that I got was like, you need to actually, you know, this is not good enough. A breadboard with an LED lighting up is cool, but that's not going to fly. What you have to do is you actually have to unlock a real car, you know, it's the mind trick where you're trying to convince someone that you have something that's real. You better unlock a real car if you do that, you know, if you want to really show it up. So right. I got into like all the it turns out with cars, there's a thing called the CAN bus. And it's you know, if you think about like when you go, when your car is broken and they plug in one of these kind of jacks to get the diagnostic information and say, oh, the computer in your car is bad or whatnot, you know, it turns out that, you know, there's a network inside your car and you can jack into that same network. And at least on older cars, you can actually send the right commands to actually unlock your car through that.
Yeah, I think they've disabled that on some of the newer ones.
Yeah, it's kind of a security yeah, thing. So that's kind of where we were, was just trying to use that to demonstrate how to unlock cars using the CAN bus. And where this led to was we were using, I'm holding up now a Raspberry Pi. And on top of the Raspberry Pi is a CAN shield. And essentially you can imagine this is pretty easy to program because it's effectively a computer, right? And I was using ClojureScript on it. You could use any language you want to program these things. And there's like a DB9 jack that can go out and just hook into your car. And this is basically what we were demoing with. And these things are evidently kind of fragile, right? You don't want to just unplug them while they're running.
Yes, that is true. Yeah.
And I lost the SD card on it once. And I think that was because I didn't know better. So we wanted to like kind of like up our game and learn how to like, well, we were worried. Like we started looking into like how do you, like there's evidently like industrial strength enclosures that you can put these things inside of to keep them powered up and try to protect, keep this thing alive, right? And we're like, maybe there's some way to do this. And I remember when I was digging into the CAN stuff, I remember seeing a lot of videos, and I hit across Bill Hurd's videos where he was messing with his car with CAN. And I'm like, oh, let's just see if we can get Bill to help us like make some real hardware that would actually survive and work. Yeah. And he fortunately said yes. He was willing to work with us and try to figure out how to do this. And for me, that was where it was almost like turning on the accelerator, right? Mm-hmm. Where now I had like this mentor effectively, who could teach me, you know, it made me actually quite kind of understand what a mentor actually is, you know. My entire life I had heard like,
yeah, what about the relationship was specific
so,
to
so for me, like it's this. Like here you have someone who has experience, who knows the ins and outs of all the stuff you're dealing with, right? And that person you can have an actual dialogue with. And that person can see the one little thing that you're missing, right? And Bill can say, hey, Mike, have you considered this little thing here? And the light bulb would go off in my, so I had always thought earlier on in my career, like a mentor was someone who had to like invest a lot of time to like teach you and ramp you up. And for me, it doesn't have to be that way. A mentor can just be the person who sees the one little thing that you're missing and just points you in the right direction, you know, and is there to, you know, has that context. And you don't get that out of a book, right? When you're learning stuff, on your own, or even watching Ben Eater, right?
Sure.
There's no human on the other end to see like what's the part that you're missing, you know?
Right. I often talk about like the one thing that's one of the hardest things in any kind of like online scenario like this is just like, what do I Google for, right? How do I know where to even start? And then if you have a mentor, if you have someone that you're directly working with, and you're kind of like, you're dancing around this idea, you're like, oh, I think I want to talk to cars. And they'll be like, CAN bus. You'll be like, what's CAN bus? And then you go down that rabbit hole. And then they'll be like, well, sometimes it's also a LIN bus. What's LIN bus? Now you have this other thing to Google for. And it's just kind of this, it's like a professional pointer outer, you know, they help you get to that point where you can go. I think you're right that any good mentoring relationship is not spoon feeding you information.
Right.
It's pointing you to the grocery store and telling you directions how to get there. And then you can go gorge yourself on that information or be like, I'm actually not that hungry and I need to go to a different store.
Yeah. One concrete example of that was I was learning how to make PCBs and how to use stencils and put solder paste on. And I was getting a lot of solder bridges, I was getting a low yield in terms of the results. And Bill's like, hey, when you look at your solder paste, are the parts of the solder on the pads touching each other ever? You know? And I'm like, yeah. It's like, well, and Bill said, you know, he basically
looked, that's bad.
And I thought from my, just when I was looking at the whole reflow thing, I thought it was like this magical thing that took care of everything for you, right? All your components just swap into place or whatever.
Right.
Due to tension.
Can you quickly explain reflow for people who don't know what it is?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's essentially, so if you go back to just like through hole stuff, you would be using solder that comes on a wire and a soldering iron, and you would be melting the solder in place. I think everyone, when they think of solder, right, that's the, at least the mental image that comes to my mind,
sure,
is
yeah.
someone with a soldering iron doing a through-hole thing. Reflow is basically you have like a PCB. I have one lying right here somewhere. Okay. But essentially you have like little, here's one over here. Yeah. I'll hold this up for the people who can see. And you have lots of pads on it, right? And essentially you put solder paste on the pads, and the paste is essentially flux mixed with, I would say, little tiny solder balls in there.
That's right.
So it's like this nice pasty mixture that's got some stickiness to it, right? So when you go to put the components on there, they stick. They stay in place roughly. You could even, I think you probably can turn the board upside down. I don't know. They stick well enough.
Yeah, there's surface tension for sure. Yeah, there's surface tension, and sometimes that allows you to get away with something. Yeah, the smaller the part, the easier it is for them to
stick. Yeah, exactly. A big honk and then go fly right off.
But
it holds it in place well enough so that you can then take that thing and put it under heat, either, typically it's an oven, right? You like a pizza oven kind of like slides through. And it goes through a certain heating profile, but effectively it melts that solder that's in that solder paste. And then when it cools back down, the things are on there good, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The surface tension, again, really impacts, because say you have like a multi-pin part, like you were showing on there, like a SOIC 816.
Yeah.
Actually, each pin has its own surface tension. And the nice thing is, because it's pulling in all directions, it kind of rights itself. And it sounds like that's what you thought was always going to happen.
Yeah.
And Bill said, well, yeah, but unless you have so much paste, it blobs it all together.
Yes. Yeah. And even I was looking at, there's another board around here that had, I don't know what the name for it is, a QFN maybe 48. It's like, okay, so it's kind of like this escalation of starting off from like big honking pads that are on the ESP32 chip, which is like,
which is a castellated edge. So that's the name of the pad.
So it's
actually like another circuit board with pads kind of cut up the side. It's like you took a through hole and you basically cut it in half. And that allows you to get to the point where now it's cut in half and you have like a half a cylinder, and then the solder can travel up that half cylinder and get to a basically solder down to a pad that's on the board below that you're trying to mount it to.
Yeah. And so like the normal pin pitch on things is, I guess, 1/10 of an inch for like breadboard things or pin headers.
Right. Yep.
And this thing that we were just now talking about with the castellated edge is half that. So I remember the first time I did one of those, it was like, oh man, this is small, you know, how can I, and I was doing it by hand, right, with the soldering iron and trying to do it without messing up. So that's when I said the word escalation, I meant like going through smaller and smaller sizes and getting down to like, you know, the first time I did like one of those SOIC 8s, you know,
this is
even smaller.
You think, yeah, exactly. It seems like the smallest thing in the world. But you don't even know about 0402 and 0201s and they keep going down from there. So I ran
into one chip that was a QFN 48, I think might be the right number of pins on it. And that thing just looked ridiculous. It's like,
it had no leads, right?
Just no leads. Yeah. It was
flat.
And yep, I'm like, so that was a great thing where I'm like, hey Bill, is this possible for a human to do by hand? And he basically said, yeah, if you're careful and you get the solder paste, you know, you can do it basically. So it's part of a mentor is just being encouraging, I guess. Right. And saying like, yeah,
I think so. Yeah. I think giving some reference points or context for like, yes, it is, but here's the steps you need to take. And I think then pointing at like, here are the pitfalls. Right. Cause I think when I look, I've been doing more RF stuff and learning in that space. And I just, I didn't know what the pitfalls were. And so everything looks like a pitfall. And so first off, that's very discouraging, I think.
Yes.
And then, if you have someone that's pointing out, it's like, oh, actually, yes, this is a very real pitfall. You should watch out for that. It's like, okay, I'll avoid that. And then they point you in the direction of like, but here's some resources. Then you basically now have a map. And again, you have to, you know, walk that path yourself, but maybe you can go and stop and ask for directions along the way if you're getting lost again. But having that map is really, really important to, I think staying motivated, getting momentum, and then moving towards your goal.
Yeah, there's even one small other concrete example when I was talking about if you do a bad job of using the stencil to put the paste on, and you have like things that will lead to solder bridges, the simplest thing that Bill told me is wipe it off and try again. I was like, my initial reaction to that is like, I would never waste the solder that I just, you know, I'm too cheap. But it's like, well, the amount of time you're going to spend fixing it afterwards is going to cost you money in terms of time. So that little thing, it's like, I don't want to say no one ever says that when you're reading about the stuff online or if you're ever watching YouTube videos, but I never did see that before. I never saw anyone like wipe it off and try again. And Bill just came out and said that right away. And that solved a lot of my solder bridge problems.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Again, it's you wouldn't know to, you wouldn't search for like, do I wipe off the solder paste? But you know, when you have someone to just guide you down that path, it can really help a lot. So
yeah.
I'm curious about so you're coming in from the software side. Can you tell us a little bit how you, and you mentioned you're using ClojureScript on the Raspberry Pi,
but first off,
can you explain what ClojureScript is and then how that has kind of played into the hardware
that you've
been building?
Yeah. So ClojureScript is, it's a programming language. It's actually a dialect of Clojure. Whereas Clojure is like a JVM Java-based thing, Clojure and ClojureScript are both, they're like hosted languages. They sit on top of either Java or JavaScript.
I get to play the dummy here today I am software challenged.
Okay,
sometimes.
So if you think the best way I would try to describe it to you is if you, let's say you're working on building some board and you needed an amplifier, right? You could go all the way to the bottom and you could say, oh, I'm just going to build a set of transistors, right?
Yeah, sure.
You could say, I'm going to get an amplifier IC. And just use something at a higher level of abstraction, right? And as far as programming languages go, you have things like assembly and C at the bottom of this stack of abstraction. And if you go higher and higher up, ultimately you get to these Lisp-like languages that are way up in the clouds, you know, but it's kind of like very abstract and very very easy to get through things because of that abstraction. A lot of the stuff is dealt with for you. If you've ever dealt with like tools like MATLAB is MATLAB, think about how it like makes it so you can represent a matrix very easily.
Yeah.
And if you compared MATLAB to something like, if you had to do that in Fortran, Fortran can fly, but man, it's going to take you a lot longer to code something like that in Fortran.
Right. So is it targeted at specific industries or specific problems that these kind of structures are built for? So like, is it built for the web? Is it built for processing stuff?
Yeah. So Clojure and ClojureScript are just high level general languages that you can use for practically anything. Uh-huh. But you know, the challenge is, getting these languages to run in different environments. And that's where, for quite a while, there was just Clojure on the JVM. And ClojureScript was created because the fact that JavaScript pretty much runs everywhere, right? Or runs in the browser. And there is a project named Esprurino that actually puts JavaScript onto chips.
Yeah, I've actually seen that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it turns out, and that class of things, probably the most popular one is MicroPython. It's the idea where you can run a high level language directly on the chip. In real time.
So that means like the interpreter is like living on the chip as well, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it turns out since ClojureScript, ClojureScript is as basically you could think of it as like a transpiler. It basically is a language that when you compile it, it takes this Lisp-like language and converts it to JavaScript that can then run in a browser or run in Esprurino.
So it's almost like a level above JavaScript then? It seems like that would be very...
I would argue it is, yeah. I would argue it's a higher level. You have higher level constructs, much like MATLAB is a higher level, you know, more abstract thing than Fortran. You know?
Yeah.
And people could argue about this all day endlessly, but that's
and they do. This is the internet, Mike. Come on.
Oh man, yeah. So it's kind of like my opinion is you should pick the most abstract tool you can to get the job done, and only reach deeper when something's not working and you have to open up the hood and go deeper and for the chip world, things like ClojureScript or MicroPython, they're at this place where like they can be useful for certain problems, you know, where you don't need the utmost in speed or, you know, because there's an interpreter, like you said, it's running this stuff. so that, you know, you're making trade-offs. You're getting like higher level programming constructs, and you can code faster, but the result is going to run a little bit more slow rather than if you had like written it directly in C.
Got it. Yeah. So then how does this all play together? So are you trying to, and then go and put this onto like an actual, so Clojure script now running, you mentioned on a Raspberry Pi, but is also running on other things?
Yeah. So that was this, so I had made, so I was, this was kind of like a project of mine, and it also was like useful at work, was just to experiment and explore running Clojure script on, a chip. And it turns out that, to do this, you need a lot of RAM.
yeah.
And this is an ESP32 that has like, oh man, I want to say like, what is it? Megabytes of RAM at least, you know? It's crazy.
Yeah, I think four meg maybe?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like,
or maybe RAM. That's the flash actually. I don't know.
It's SPI RAM. So there is some sort of thing that's off the chip that's giving you extra RAM. Mm-hmm. But but the cool thing is it's like, it's enough. It's enough RAM to run this really high level language and actually establish what you would call a REPL into it. REPL stands for read, eval, print loop. If you have Python, you have the same thing, like a REPL there where you're basically jacked in and you can type commands. It's almost like if you ever had like experienced basic computers, Bill Hurd, like the Commodore, you know, put on the Commodore 64, flip that thing on, you're in a REPL, right? You can type things into it right away and you get that immediate feedback and gratification and that loop.
Mm-hmm. And frustration when you type something wrong too. Don't
oh yeah.
That.
Right away. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it's really useful. I've actually done that with CircuitPython and MicroPython. MicroPython's on the ESP32. I've done that on CircuitPython as well, which is on some of the SAMD stuff, and that's more sponsored by the Adafruit folks. And it is really useful for kind of throwing commands at things and trying them out, like, especially if you're trying to talk to a particular chip.
Yeah.
I find that that's really useful for like prototyping and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
So,
all right.
So how does it work for what you're trying to do now? So you've now built a REPL for the ESP32 to run Clojure script. Mm-hmm. Does it have like kind of function specific things that you're capable of doing in Clojure script?
So
what are you trying to do with it?
Yeah. Like if you were trying to mess around with something and you're like, I just want to try, you know, I want to send some SPI commands, to another chip that's on the board or whatever. And you're trying to mess around. Fortunately, Esperino is the answer to a lot of that. Esperino and its JavaScript implementation has like all the hooks you need to like get at the hardware from the higher level. On this particular board, there's GPIO pins that you can get at, and all that's done, kudos to Esperino. It's built this entire environment, you know, and JavaScript where you can just at a really abstract level, just say, hey, flip this thing this way or do pulse width modulation on a certain pin, you know, pin and have it flash.
Right.
For you. And from the Clojure script level, Clojure script has a way to kind of like make it fairly straightforward to do JavaScripty kind of things to interact at the next layer down.
Got it.
So you can.
So it's almost like it's like a pass through then. So it's written like Clojure script, but it basically is doing similar stuff to what the Esperino JavaScript implementation would be doing.
Yep. You could imagine like if you slapped Esperino on there and you were messing around doing the same thing, and Clojure script is roughly the same thing. You're just using a different language instead of using JavaScript. You're using Clojure script.
Huh.
Just at a different level. Yeah.
That's great. So what are you using this thing for? Are you just using it to kind of hack around and try different things?
So it's for at work. It would be just using it to prototype, exactly like you said, to try to figure out things whenever it's a faster way to get to things. But in the end, like if you're going to put an actual chip into a car or whatnot, or certain use cases, you then have to like be pragmatic and you have to say, well, maybe this is, you know, maybe we're not there yet in terms of like the speeds needed or all that kind of stuff. So it's like you exactly said, the same arguments would apply maybe to MicroPython or any of these like high level languages. They're great for prototyping and they have their uses. And maybe another decade from now, it'll just be useful for everything because all these chips will be so fast, right?
Right. Yeah, I think that we are benefiting from the explosion of, you know, available micros and processing power that's out there. It's just that the real problem is that if you want it to run off a battery, it's usually going to be kind of tough to do that.
And that's okay. So that part of why I did this was to learn, mm-hmm. and everything. Like I wanted to learn how to make a PCB, and I wanted, I basically made it so that it's, I'm holding up the board again, showing that it's connected to a LiPo. I wanted to learn how to do like battery charging circuitry, and perhaps get it wrong or whatever. You know, the only way to find out is to try it at a certain point and just dig into it and read the data sheets and figure out like, oh, this, that, and the other. Even in the background, I have an oven, so I learned how to do that. So
is that a Control-Leo 2 on there, or what's, what do you?
This is a Control-Leo 2, or actually a Control-Leo 3, and it was built for me by Bill Hurd.
He's
like, perhaps going to get into making these things. So, and that was another thing I wanted to learn was how to do that. So for me, like I took this thing and I gave a talk about it and I slapped the thing up on Tindy so people could get it. And that gave me an opportunity to like use the oven, right? Like I'm not going to make like a lot of these for myself, but if people are getting them off Tindy, then that gives me an excuse to like, and I learned a lot.
Nothing like commerce to really get your motivation up, huh? And like, it was like, oh wow, someone paid me for this. I better go build some and make sure they work.
Yeah. So it makes you worry. Am I going to like burn someone's house down if I build a board that, you know, is not doing the right thing? Right. Mm-hmm. Or it makes you worry about a lot of stuff. Like you're going to give something to another human being that, you know, you're letting this thing go into the world and you want to make sure that, so that, yes, you're right. That puts you in a whole different mindset. We're like, not only does this have to work, but it has to work without me around to keep it working. Right.
Yeah. Well, actually manufacturing is its own, you know, it's its own discipline, and the manufacturing engineers out there are shaking their head or nodding their heads rather and saying, yeah, it's not easy. So, I think there is a chasm from like, you know, building your first one to building your 100th one. It's a challenge, and it's a fun bit of challenge. So, what else were some of the challenges as you were getting to those prototypes and those first early units? What did you run into? Because I'm particularly interested in like the perspective of someone who's coming from the software world, right? Yeah. It seems like, you know, and maybe even specifically at a high level language kind of thing, like some of this stuff under the hood is maybe taken care of for you. Like I'm sure that someone with your experience, you know, you have to dig down and build other stuff up. But like, my experience has always been with hardware. It stops at the silicon usually, but you know, from there on up, you're in charge of making things are hooked together properly. And there's not many guardrails to getting things right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oops. So let's see. So this actually was not the first, prototype I made. I made another one before this to learn, you know, some mistakes from,
only two. That's not bad, Mike.
Well, one thing I learned, is I was, for some reason I was obsessed with making things very small and compact on the board and like trying to this new world of surface mount stuff, since it is small, why don't I just cram it into like as small geometry as I can? And I learned, that's not, well, at least from my limited experience so far, that was not a good result. You know, I ended up getting a linear regulator that was like, I didn't realize how small it was until it came back from DigiKey. It was like 2 millimeters by 2 millimeters square.
They make them real tiny if you're not careful. And the problem is too, I feel like when you're on a DigiKey or Mouser, like the preview size, you know, every part looks about the same size. And then, you know, one's the size of your fist and the other one's the size of your, you know, of a grain of sand. So it's not fun.
And that little thing like was a pain to get to work. Like I would have to solder it on and I didn't have an oven at the point. I was using a hot air thing to try to get it on there. And even after I got it to work, if I put my finger on it, that thing was hot. You know, I don't know if it, like the thermal properties of it weren't necessarily right. So I just got a big honking linear regulator and put it on there. That was one lesson I learned, you know, just all types of little things of how, you know, you have to almost just do it to learn like how to avoid, like I was mentioning, solder bridges and I'm sure there's even things I'm learning now. Like I probably screwed up all the signal integrity stuff, right? In terms of I have traces going overlapping each other and stuff like that. You know, I'm now reading the Bogatin books and like making me feel bad. Like, oh man, you have to like, if you don't have something that you built, you can't think back to that and think, oh, did I do that part right?
right. Well, it's kind of like we talked about. It's like, so you go and read a signal integrity book.
Yeah.
And I was very much like this, you know, I go to start reading one and it basically, for me, it was like going to Aardvark or the dictionary where it was, I didn't know what I was talking about.
You need some
about.
Context to like.
Yeah, exactly. But once you've built a board and you're like, why is my serial line not working if I'm above 96, you know, 9600 baud? It's like, oh, well, you know, maybe you should make loop-de-loops in your board, Chris. And and then you start to learn these things, though. And then it is this kind of push-pull of like, well, it worked this time, it didn't work this time. And you need a lot of trial and error there.
And to me, the idea of inductance and all that is so non-intuitive. Like I was a mechanical engineer, and I, you know, it's like things I can grasp and understand. This electrical stuff that you can't see, it's, I guess we all fall back on just analogs of how, you know, how that stuff works, and just loop inductance and all that stuff is still like at the periphery of my ability to grok and even understand what I'm doing wrong, you know, when I design a board.
Yeah. So, how did the mechanical stuff play in that? Like, well, first off, when did you switch from mechanical to the software side?
Oh yeah. So I didn't know what I was going to be when I was a kid, you know, so I was influenced by like the Apollo stuff and rockets and building, you know, machines. And to me, the closest thing to that was, you know, mechanical engineering, and it's like stuff you could grasp, you know, and even aerospace engineering is just something much more readily graspable for me, at least. And electronics has always been this thing, like, it's like this mysterious world of stuff you can't see. Right. And it's dangerous too. You don't want to touch it because it kill you. Right.
Sometimes, you know, low voltage is a little safer. Yeah. You know, stay below 5 volts and you're going to be just fine.
So I had pretty much ignored electronics my whole life. You know, I knew that it existed and had heard all the terms that we always hear, but never like dug into learning it.
But that got you into the software side as well as the electronics.
The software for me. So when I was growing up, the two big things that really like influenced me were the Apollo things, Apollo missions, and these computers you could buy, the Commodore 64 and stuff like that. These things rocked my world, right? You know, here we have people going to the moon, and you could get a computer in your house, and you could control your TV set. You could type something into it, and it would do something that like was logical, and it would. So I was always hooked on both from the beginning, and it's just. That's an example of the world that you're living in. Having great things like that available to you can really influence you when you're young.
It sounds like changing your environment in general. Like I feel like that's still the magical gateway for people getting started. It's like the easy example is like an LED, like lighting up an LED is like immediately changing your environment with not much consequence, but like, boy, does it still feel magical, especially when you're towards the beginning of your, you know, electronics journey.
Yeah. So I guess like with all these things, ultimately you have to control something to make it meaningful, right? Otherwise it's just generating heat on a board. Definitely the stuff that I'm doing at work, actually like walking out with my iPhone and pushing a button on it or with an Apple Watch and my car just unlocks, right? It's like, that's cool to be able to control the world that you live in. And for me, I guess electronics to me is like all these things that I thought were coming from somewhere else, or that were out of my reach, like even like something like a remote control for your TV set. Once you realize you can build that yourself too, it's like so empowering, right? You're like, if I want one of these, I can make it. There's nothing to stop you at that point from like dreaming up something cool to build. And that's just intoxicating, right? Like,
Agency is a powerful tool, I think. And, you know, wanting to be able to go change your environment and being like, it's pretty cheap. That's the other thing. I think it's just so cheap now compared to how it used to be. I mean, getting even a Ben Eater, you know, style computer from Ben Eater, like the parts, it's like, you know, a couple hundred bucks to build up this thing and have a whole bunch of parts that you can go and work on. You know?
One thing along those lines, this is one cool thing we've been getting into at work is UWB. And this even like, this is even exciting Bill Hurd, because it's
UWB like a ultra wideband.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Ultra wideband. And the cool thing about it, you almost have to experience this yourself where the thing that it does do is it can measure distances to other UWB chips by sending a pulse of ultra wideband signal. That's got a timestamp on it. That's really accurate. That's got like gigahertz clock and running inside of it. And the counter is zipping up in it. It's fast enough to put an accurate enough timestamp on it. So you can actually use the speed of light to measure the round trip as it comes back. And you can actually measure things like down to the centimeter level accuracy. So you can set up a locker on your car and like you can move this towards it. And there's this invisible barrier that you can cross.
Yeah.
And I know that this stuff is cool to me, but I noticed like when my kids look at it and they're like, what? You know, they see like, you know, like they imagine like there's an invisible bubble around your car. I'm like, That's exactly right. Yeah, there's, and it's so cool to be able to like actually put that stuff together. And I think arguably you have to delve into electronics to be able to like assemble things like that or put it together. Like if you're just going to stick in the software world, you can do awesome things there too. But like, if you start to like dig into this stuff as well, you can make things that like, even your kids are like astonished with. You're like,
well, I feel like RF has its own particular brand of magic because it's not just an LED where you like flip a switch over here and an LED comes on because you can see it's physically connected. It's like you flip a switch over here and then like across the room the LED goes on. It's like, oh wow, okay, now something's happening. You know?
And that's where I'm at now in terms of like the cool peripheral edge is just like the dipping my toe into the RF pool. So I've got myself a little VNA and, and Bill's been digging into that too. He's got, you know, even higher end VNAs. And it's like, just, it's all like, you know, when you're designing a board and you're dealing with logic gates, that's one way of looking at everything. But then when you're dealing with RF, it's a whole different world, right? Like the stuff doesn't even, the electricity evidently doesn't even flow through the conductors. It's like on the skin, on the surface and,
skin effect.
Yeah. And like, you can't like you have, my oscilloscope can't measure any of this stuff. It's gone so fast. It's like, and I, you know, I mentioned that to Bill and he's like, Bill's like, my entire life, everything that's new that comes out, none of the gear you have can measure it. You know, it's like, you're always like delving into new
things. You're always a couple seasons behind.
And I guess even for Bill back in the 80s or whatever, with TTL chips, even like oscilloscopes were just able to measure stuff like that. So it's like, now we're in this world where you need a dedicated DNA device to measure what it's doing. And for me, it's like another whole interesting set of things to learn with respect to wave propagation and all that kind of stuff. That's just like very intellectually stimulating, you know, and it actually, you can measure it. It's not just like stuff you read in a book. You can put it together and hook up your VNA and you can see like, oh man. So one example of that was I built a, I wasn't making this myself, but I was like copying a reference design and I laid out like an antenna matching network between a BLE capable chip and the actual antenna that it would go out. And I just like laid it out in a pretty straightforward way. And Bill looked at that and he's like, you probably want to like make that all smaller and close together. And I did that and respun another board with it smaller and then measured it with a VNA. And I could see like so much, you know, when I was doing like the Smith chart stuff, right? And you could see that the thing stayed right in the center of the Smith chart. Whereas with that larger initial design I did, the Smith chart was all over the place.
Yeah, loopy loopy.
And it's like,
And Smith charts are kind of their own thing. I actually didn't realize you were getting into that side of things.
Just putting my toe into it, right? And that's arguably that's stuff that even Bill Hurd is finding intellectually stimulating at his point in his career. He's like, there's some really weird stuff that goes on when you start to deal with RF. And it's not like, you can't just say, if I hook these two wires together, like I said, like it worked. The first design I did, actually, I was able to connect up and do BLE with it. It worked. But the gain was probably, you know.
You just get to the edge of the table instead of across the room. And I think that's the other nice thing is that there's the chips are so so well designed and like tolerant of my mistakes that that they still work enough. And it's like, well, that's a good start. And then you can start to optimize.
Just thinking of how tolerant this stuff is. There's a connector standard called IPX or UFL. It's like a little, I don't know if I have one of these around here, but it's like when you have an antenna and you snap it onto your board, there's like tiny, they're kind of annoying.
They're actually coaxial. It's basically because you have like a cup and then there's a center pin that's coming up out of the cup. And this is like flat against the board. And then on the other side, there is now a coaxial cable that then kind of has like a sucker that goes down over that center pin. And then the rest kind of sucks down around the cup, the outside of the cup. And that's the center pin is the conductor and the outside is the ground.
Okay. So I had soldered my UFL thing on backwards.
Oh yeah. That'll do
like,
it. Yeah.
So like the ground in was hooked to the RF transmission line. Like how did this even work? And Bill's like, well, your entire board was probably radiating RF.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
The ground plane was radiating, and that's how you're.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, that sounds bad because all of it's reflecting back into the chip, and
Sometimes I wish there was like a way to actually visualize like in real time, like from like eyeglasses to like see what, you know, RF fields are doing within a certain band. It's, that would be the ultimate way to like visualize and start to like get more into it. I mean, it's all down to intuition. So, it sounds like that's what you're building as well. As someone coming from the software world into the electronics world, mm-hmm. it sounds like you're building up these intuitive models to start to see things clearly. And that's what Bill's kind of giving you as a mentor.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely that intuition is like, if I push on this thing here, will it move over there?
And yeah, right.
It's like, you have to build that. Like when you're designing something, there's no way to start from just raw formulas and calculations. You have to have intuition and high level.
Well, and I feel like that's a big piece of troubleshooting as well. Right. So troubleshooting is all about, you know, experience, I think. Right. And so that's when something that a mentor can really help is to basically lend you their experience. Mm-hmm. And then intuition is like, you know, well, I think there's also a rigor element as well of like, okay, I wanted to try to change this one thing and then see, does it do anything down the line? No, it doesn't. Okay, I'll go back to the first beginning and I'll start to iterate and try it again, iterate, try it again. But then the intuition is, okay, now the fourth thing I tried, I wiggled the connector here and it started working. Your intuition starts to build and say, oh, there may be a connection problem, or there may be, maybe I hooked the ground into the connector or the conductor right? And but it's building that over time. So like, as you've been building mm-hmm. your intuition, are there any like models that pop out to you that you didn't have 6 months ago or a year ago or you know, at the beginning?
Well, one thing you just said reminded me of something that wasn't obvious to me right away, which is when you're building these things, it is always good when it fails.
Oh yeah.
Right. That's your chance to learn. And I think that's where I've learned almost every, you know, like if it works the first time, did you really learn anything? I guess, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, it worked, but maybe it's only working on accident, right?
Right.
And when it fails, then you're like, then that's your opportunity to start digging deeper and like, what's going on? What did I miss? What part did I hook up wrong? And that to me, it's the same thing with programming. You just have to do it and have something fail. And then that causes your gears to start turning. You're like, why is this failing? And you do need to like rely on intuition to see from the big picture, like what could be causing this, you know? And sometimes you can't even see what's doing it because it might be a solder bridge underneath a chip or something. And you have to start probing around and like thinking mental model, building up mental models like, okay, if this is doing this, then that must imply something else. You're wrong. And you go down that path and you find out that's not it. And I think that's pretty much one thing I've learned in general is just the fact that you learn the most when things fail, which that's been true for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, we talked a little bit about earlier about like knowing what to Google for as well. And mm-hmm. like, even though it can get a little confusing as you dive down that rabbit hole and like trying to mm-hmm. figure out what all of the different variations of your problems can be, like seeing all of them and then starting to hone in mm-hmm. on the actual problem, it can really start to kind of broaden your scope of what's out there and what is a possible error. But then when you start mm-hmm. to actually figure out what it is, you start to see, and it's, especially if you see it a second time, mm-hmm. then you start to see, okay, now there's these models of things that could go wrong and did go wrong in your case. And then you kind of file away in a library that you can look at the next time.
One example is where my intuition was completely wrong, or my mental model was completely wrong, which is when you have a signal going down a trace from one chip to another. Mm-hmm. My mental model was that it would send the signal there and then the return path would involve, it's kind of like the same thing going backwards, right? Along mm-hmm. the return path.
Along the same line
along the ground. And I understood enough at that point that it actually would follow it right underneath mm-hmm. like the what's it, the path of least inductance or path of least impedance.
Well, yeah, usually people think resistance at first, but it is truly impedance. So like if you have a high inductance path, it's going to be like, I don't want to go there either. So
so the mental model that I had wrong was, I would imagine like, you would send a signal and it would propagate out to the chip, and then my mental model was that the return would be like kind of a similar wave going back the opposite way. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that it was happening as the signal went out, like the entire time it's like coming backwards. And I didn't mm-hmm. get that, to be honest, until Bill showed me a video of it, you know, a visualization that someone had made showing the field strengths and whatnot as the signal propagated.
Oh yeah, was it the one where like you actually see the like the heat map as
lots
as,
of
like,
colors the, and lots of little
yeah
arrows.
Fields are growing and shrinking. Yeah, those yeah. are magical and, things. That's and, kind of the close. That's kind of what I imagined when I talked about just having glasses to see fields.
Yes,
and that would be if you could do that live. Through like some kind of smart glasses, that would be like the best case scenario. But like the amount of processing that even took, it probably took, you know, 2 hours to render that video.
Yeah.
And it's based on static data.
But
so,
it,
yeah.
it was shocking to me because I was like, oh man, I've been thinking about this the wrong way the entire time. Mm-hmm. And then once I yeah. saw that with my own eyes, I'm like within half a second, I realized I was wrong. And I'm sure. like, now I have this new mental model.
Sure.
You
sure.
have to
well,
see.
And I think the other troublesome thing is that it changes, some of that behavior can change at different frequencies as well, right? So if you have a really yeah. low, slow analog signal, it might actually, you know, take a meandering path back or something. But yeah, it's just, yeah. Thinking about electricity, it really is a lot in our heads. And, you know, electrons are going to do whatever they want to do. Sometimes they'll just go yeah. off and radiate into the, you know, okay, see you later, electron. Now you're EMI. And yeah, it's just, it's a crazy, crazy world out there of how this stuff works.
And that's the place where I'm at now, where I struggle with is like when you're building something and you know these rules that you've been reading about and whatnot, you're like, well, I probably shouldn't do that. And then it's I struggle with like, how do I know that this is actually going to work? And I've never like gone down the path of actually like saying, okay, let's simulate this board with a you know software. I'm still at this place where I'm like, I'm just building the thing and trying it and seeing if it works and if it comes back, yeah. maybe probing it to try to figure out or try to visualize.
Sure.
I'm not
so,
at that point.
So you're basically yeah. taking advantage of kind of the low cost hardware and you're just saying it's worth my time to go and just build it and get it done and try it.
Yeah. That's just the level of where I'm at in terms of my expertise right now. I
think that's a great way to do it, honestly. I mean, I think it's, you know, especially if it's for a non, you know, even if it is for a work project but you have that ability to go spend time on it, it's like, yeah, you're going to really be able to dig in and learn a lot that way.
Yeah. A lot of these things that I'm working on now, they just have to fundamentally work from like a prototype standpoint. It's not like I'm building something that millions of them are being made.
Right. You know? Duct tape and bubble gum is fine as long as it gets through the demo and you can show it to someone and it works there.
But if you can invent those magical glasses that would let me even see what the board is doing.
I think I'm the first pair, but after that you can be the second pair. I'm like, well, we'll do a Kickstarter or something, you know, like we'll just really, I think they'll be popular amongst
the, like the glasses
people.
Will slow down time and you can see the wave propagate
sure.
and you can
yeah,
see,
yeah. yeah. Why not? They're magical glasses. They can do whatever we want, you know?
Yeah,
yeah. That's great. So what are you building now? I mean, so you've built this board, you have the ESP32 board that you built and you designed and you're still selling?
Yes. Yep. It's still up on Tendi. Yeah.
So we'll have a link to that.
Yeah.
What are you building next?
So,
what is your next
the
journey?
The stuff that I'm digging into at work now all surrounds this UWB stuff.
Got it.
And, you know, learning how to control the RF on those things. So one interesting thing that's happened is, if you look into the ultra wideband world, there seems to be one major vendor, DecaWave that makes the chips.
DecaWave.
And all their, have you heard of that company?
No, just sounds like, I just feel like there's like a room where these names came up and they were all like in the 80s. You know, like Deca and Hexa and, you know, like, I don't know. I just, it sounds very retro, even though I'm sure they're a very modern company in many ways.
Oh, so
they're advanced, you know.
So
yeah.
what's strange is that they seem to have like the only, it's kind of weird, the only chips that do this stuff. They're the only game in town to do ultra wideband. Of course, now Apple has ultra wideband in the iPhone itself, but you know, but you can't buy those chips, right? So if you say, I want, like if you say, hey, Chris, you want to go make something with if you want to mess around with UWB, you're going to be messing with the DecaWave chips, I bet.
Yep. Yeah,
and the interesting thing is they're all sold out right now.
Oh,
all the modules basically are.
Yeah.
So now we're working on building like, you can still get the actual chip. You can get the processor, if you will. You can't buy the entire module that has the little UWB antenna on the end and all
that. Got it. Yeah. So like a module versus a chip solution. Module solution would have the antenna on it. It would have the matching components. It would be it'd be like buying the Espressif ESP32 chip versus what do they call it? The WROOM, the room.
Room. Yeah.
32
whatever, how do you pronounce
module
that? Yeah. Yes.
That has pre-certified for FCC.
Yes. It's got FCC on the lip. Yeah.
Yeah,
so you can't
exactly.
buy these right now. Like if you go to DigiKey, they're none left.
They're gone.
I have five of them. So I have like,
that's good. Guard them with your life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's what I'm, so to answer your question, what I'm doing now is just digging into like, how do you, you know, how do you build stuff with the chips directly? How do you like measure the round trip times even better? Because you can use, you know, very basic algorithms to do that, or you can get fancier and fancier, you know, more, you know, multiple round trips and whatnot.
Yeah.
So that's a fun world to live in.
Yeah. What is the frequency range those things are operating at?
Oh, yes. It's up at the higher channels. It's like 6 gigahertz. So the VNA I have can't go that high. So I'm like, now I want to drop 10 grand on a VNA.
Oh, don't do it. Don't do it.
Yeah.
You can rent them. That's the thing I've learned. Okay. Yeah. You can rent them per week, per day. It's not cheap still, but it's cheaper than owning, and you'll get a brand new one that always works.
Yeah. Like you can get these Rigol oscilloscopes for like $300 now. It's amazing. Yeah. The stuff you can buy these days. But in the VNA world, no.
It's still a very sliver of the audience. I think as there's more people getting into it, more people looking at UWB, I think they'll, you know, do more of that stuff.
Yeah.
It'll drive down into the lower end.
You can get like, this is a pocket VNA. And one thing that's all the rage now is something called the Nano VNA. And the VNA is like $50.
Yep.
I don't know how good it is, but it's a VNA, right?
Well, it's limited to, I think like 900 megahertz is kind of the top of its range.
Okay. Yeah.
Maybe even lower than that. It's definitely popular for the hams that are out there.
You can't complain. Like it's $50. Yeah.
Yeah. $50 is like even just to play around with it and try it out. You can go and look at how capacitors respond, inductors. I think it actually does help to build mental models. And then, you know, you got to learn Smith charts and things like that. But to start to build up, you know, these resources, there's, Alan Wolke is a YouTuber. I love his channel W2AEW on YouTube. I highly recommend that one.
I want to claim that probably a third of everything I understand right now is from his videos. He is so clear, you know, and his explanations of how things work.
Right. Right. There's another one, Tom Tech Lab, maybe. I'm trying to remember what it is, but I'll try and link it as well. But there's another one where basically he uses nano VNAs and analog discovery twos, which is how I found it. That's a low cost piece of equipment that's very hard to find right now as well, unfortunately. But great for experimenting. And that's what we use for the course as well. Highly recommend those as like a starter scope as well.
I feel like I'm like a kid in a candy store again with the whole VNA thing. Yeah. It's like,
see, I think Mike, you represent the most dangerous demographic here because you have the salary of, and the backing of a company of a software engineer.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the predilections to go and buy hardware equipment and off eBay, man. It's a dangerous place. You can really, you can really burn a hole in your pocket. I actually got a notification today that more of my eBay swag has been coming in. It's just a deep dark hole. You can go down and buy more stuff. So be careful, my friend.
Yes. Okay.
So Mike, where can people find out more about you and maybe, find your products and, talk to you online?
Yeah. So I work for Vouch. Vouch.io is that company. And I'm also, I have a unique name like you do, Chris. So you can Google me. I'm Mike Fikes. I didn't even know what my Twitter ID is. Probably M Fikes, you know?
It's M Fikes. Yeah. Okay. We've been having flash across the screen a little bit here.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's great. So that's, you're on Twitter a lot and like interacting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I get into the whole closure world. You'll see me talking a lot about that stuff too. So
And you gave a talk recently. You referred to it. What was that at?
That was at Closure North, which is virtually is in Canada.
Of course. Yeah.
These days. Yeah.
Yes. This is the new way we live is through screens, we'll link that in as well.
That was
a great talk. And you talk about similar things that we talked about here, but probably more in depth on that talk. So that was really, really a cool presentation.
Thanks.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun. I mean, it's fun to be like, I imagine like the people back at Xerox PARC who could do messing around with software and hardware. And I'm like, oh man, this is so cool. You know, it's like awesome to be able to just like, I guess it's the world we live in now today where you can just send off for PCBs and they come back a week later. Maybe our kids will just print them off and they'll be, another generation of TILBs even more direct.
Yeah. Hopefully there's still a lot of interest in it. I think the dropping cost of electronics definitely makes, you know, the interest level goes up and that has been great for, you know, getting to meet new people like yourself and really personally, I love when software people come into the electronics space because you often bring tool sets and mindsets that are like so different from kind of how I started in the hardware world.
Okay.
I feel like that's just a, you know, so like I do revision control now. Like, oh, yes, yeah. I should have known about that sooner, but like, yeah. but like doing that in the hardware world is, you know, kind of, I no longer get the, very specifically remember getting the, you know, Rev 48 part 2 - use this one .zip from a former coworker.
Yeah, that's crazy. How did you
get that anymore.
Yeah. Like, you're going to revise your schematic without checking it in. I'm like, how do you, of course, yeah, it's the mixture of two worlds, right?
Exactly. Yeah. All right, great. Well, people should definitely check out Mike's video, and we'll link all that stuff in here. And thanks again, Mike, for being part of us here, and looking forward to talking again soon.
All right. Thank you.
So that was our interview with Mike Fikes talking about ClojureScript and building custom hardware that can work with it in the real world. I think it's really great to pair up software and hardware like that. And I think that a lot of people that are either watching or listening to this podcast and or interested in the Contextual Electronics course, which is another part of Contextual Electronics, where there's a course where we teach you how to build hardware, a lot of people are coming in from the software world. So if you are a software person and you're interested in building hardware and you need a little help, the Contextual Electronics course will help try and guide you through and start to build your own hardware. You can also take the path like Mike has done. You know, he's built stuff on breadboards. He's kind of worked his way up to building his own custom hardware, and he's found mentors. All of those steps are also really great for building, to get into building your own custom hardware. At the end of the day, you want to build something that you can develop and design and put out into the world and hopefully change your environment. That's what we're really trying to do here. And I love that Mike was doing that specifically for ClojureScript, which is something that's not normally associated with changing real world variables, but he is making that change because it's something he wants to be able to do. So again, if you're interested in doing this, you can always sign up for contextualelectronics.com. We have basically monthly memberships, and that's something where there's a bunch of different courses there and you can follow along. It's kind of like an apprenticeship style, and that's something that we offer as part of the Contextual Electronics experience. We'll have more podcasts here. If you're interested, please go and check out the YouTube channel. That's where you can watch all of these videos. You can always subscribe in a podcast listener like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, any of those, Google Podcasts. And of course, if you share it with your friends, we would love to, have more people learn about this course and also see more guests that we have who are working on electronics in various ways like Mike did. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next episode.